All right, good morning, you all. No, that's good. It feels like that tryptophan is still kind of with you from the turkey, you know. This morning, we're privileged again to do part two of our series, Science by Design. And we're going to be hearing about how great our God is, but we're going to be doing that through looking at the natural world. You see, the proper study of science really ought to lead you to worship. And so there's a couple reasons that we're doing this session on Science by Design. First of all, I hope that many of you are just overwhelmed by the things that are presented. You say, whoa, that's just over our head. Well, that's good, because God is over our head. We can't fit him into a neat little scientific equation. He's greater than we can imagine. And you know, all the cool stuff we're seeing now, God is up in heaven saying, this is just scratching the surface. Man, I'd love to show you what I really know. And one day we'll see it all. So science should lead us to worship. We're also doing this for the practical need that we live in a culture where there's a mindset that science has replaced faith. You know, faith is just kind of one of those things you tuck away for a few rituals, but science has really got everything solved, and science kind of overthrows faith. Well, that's not true. What you're going to see here is that science and the Bible mesh together beautifully. So this morning, we're going to be hearing from Didi Kuo and Jack Knox. They are tag-teaming, just as they did last week. They need no further introduction. If you're here last week, I'd encourage you. If you missed it, you can listen to it online. We have handouts that you should have gotten also with your bulletin this morning. They're out in the back there. There's extra copies if you didn't pick one up. But that's something you can use with some of the notes and references that they speak about. So with no further ado, let me pray, and then we'll have you guys up here. Heavenly Father, we come to you and we worship you. You are the one who made the heavens and the earth, everything in this universe. Lord, you are greater than this universe. I pray that you would give us a humility to see that when we look around at the world around us, that it points to you and that everything is by design. Lord, I pray that you would give us confidence to withstand people may be poking fun at us or saying, well, how can you believe that? Science has disproved this. No, Lord, we know that your truth is abiding and will last forever. So I pray that we would have a greater sense of awe for you today and also a greater sense of confidence. In Jesus' name, amen.
All right. Thank you, Mark. It's good to be up here for the second part of our lesson now on science by design. We're going to kind of do the same thing we did last time, where Jack and I are going to tag team. I'll talk a little bit on the physics and cosmology side, and Jack will talk about the biology wonders of our world. So just a quick recap for those who weren't here last time. Today's popular culture really likes to pit science against God and make it look like it's really incompatible set of beliefs. If you're a scientist, you really can't believe in God. And in some cases, on the religious side, you know, all those scientists are a bunch of atheists and don't listen to them. And there's a somewhat of an adversarial relationship out there. And I think in some cases, it's even crept into our educational system where, you know, science is just taught as something that is fact, and religion and God is something as fiction, and never the two should meet. A lot of this came about in the term I use, scientific materialism, back in the 19th century. When folks decided that the universe always existed and just through random happenstance, particles built into elements, and they formed into the soup, the biological soup, as organic soup, as Jack called it, and evolved into life. But something important to note is this hasn't always been the case in terms of scientists being perceived as atheists. A lot of the greatest scientists, Newton, Galileo, had strong faith that really urged them out to discover the world because they knew there was a creator behind it. And their discoveries, which has really undergird the science of today, was based on their faith in God. The other part is a lot of the modern discoveries in physics and cosmology, I talked a little bit about that last time, quantum mechanics, string theory, and so on, it was really pointing to an intelligent design. The fact that a Big Bang has happened, and that's pretty much been confirmed to science, showed that time is finite, and there was not an infinite amount of time for things to evolve. And so I think many of these latest discoveries actually point back to a designer. And another thing that we're going to talk a little bit about today is the fact that it seems there's a lot of what we call fine-tuning of parameters within physics and biology and every other scientific field, really designed for life, and that it wasn't just happened to be a random chance. I want to make clear, I don't know if I said this last time, I'm not trying to use science to prove the existence of God, because that removes faith, which is obviously a key part of Christianity. What I'm trying to show is the position that science disproves God is far from true, and the fact that you can actually have a career in science for those who are looking into the scientific field or engineering and still have a belief in God, and those two are not incompatible. So let me talk a little bit about fine-tuning. Who's heard of the term fine-tuning in the universe? Okay, good. So a couple of you have heard that. It's really kind of taken the scientific field by storm. And really what it's saying is for us humans to exist today, there are so many parameters in nature that have to be near perfect for this for us to be here. And this is seen across many disciplines of science, from the basic physics out to the cosmology of the universe, into the life and evolution, or excuse me, the biology today that really is important that Jack will talk about later on in terms of how life came about. And the fact is, these parameters are far too precise to have occurred randomly. So naturally, this has caused some consternation among some folks who in the scientific field who really don't want to acknowledge the fact of God. This is a very widely debated topic in sort of researching this area over the past week or two. If you just go on any of the internet sites or blogs that talk about this, you can see the back and forth between the community that really believes that this fine-tuning is not a fact, or does not point to the fact that there's a designer or God, the folks who really believe that this fine-tuning is a result of a creator. So that topic, again, I encourage you to go online and just type in or Google fine-tuning. You'll see a lot of the websites out there that talk about it if you want to hear a little bit more than what I'm covering today. Because of that, there's now alternative explanations that folks who, again, want to deny the existence of God, and I'll talk about this in a little second, that they're given out there to say, hey, yeah, there may be fine-tuning, but really it's because of other things that are happening out there, which I'll talk about in a second. But the fact of fine-tuning, and I don't know if you can read the quote in there, is really widely accepted among physicists and cosmologists, the fact that it's fine-tuned for life. Now, the interpretation of that is still hotly debated, as I mentioned here before. So let me talk a little bit, some examples of fine-tuning. There's about, and on the physics side, there's about 30 characteristics of the universe that are really fine-tuned. And these, as you can see, range from the very small, the ratio, for example, electron to proton mass has to be fine-tuned within 1 to 10 to the 37th power there for the basic elements to exist, out to the scale of the universe. The expansion rate of the universe, the mass of the universe has to be fine-tuned for the galaxies and stars that we depend on for life to exist. So you can see this set of fine-tuning exists across the whole scale from small to large, and it's really hard to comprehend some of these numbers. So I want to give a couple examples, and I think Jack's got a couple examples here in his part. But when we talk about something of 1 to the 10 to the 37th, and in some cases up to 1 to the 10th and the 120th power, what does that really mean? So, for example, not that I'm encouraging anybody to do the lottery here, but if you were to do the lottery and you wanted to win the Powerball jackpot twice, what are the odds of that? That is 1 in 10 to the 16th power there. If you were to put a grain of sand that's, say, colored red out there and hit it somewhere out in the beaches of the world, the odds of just going out and picking just the right sand among all the particles of sand out there is 1 in 10 to the 20th. Here's another example. If you covered dimes across the entire northern continent and stacked it all the way to the moon, and then you took that with 1 billion continents and then put, again, a red dime in there, the odds of just happening to picking that dime out is 1 in 10 to the 37th. So now you look at the odds of life happening in this universe, again, based on the chart before, that's about 1 in 10 to the 124th. So the idea here is really you have to be someone with a lot of faith to believe that life just happened randomly with all those fine-tuned parameters. In fact, some would say you need more faith as an atheist to believe in that than you do as a Christian to believe in God and the Bible. So again, as you saw in the last chart with that quote, this is pretty much widely accepted within the scientific community that, boy, it just seems very odd that things have to happen in such a very, very, very non-random way for life to occur. Some other things here, for example, is the design of our galaxy, and it's key to our location of where we are in the galaxy. You don't want to be in the middle of that galaxy. There's a lot of nasty stuff like radiation and debris like asteroids and everything that would make life prohibitive. You really want to be out in the spiral arm of the galaxy, which we happen to be. As a result, we live in what we call a very nice life zone of the galaxy that not only allows our planet to provide life. We're out there. The other interesting part that folks have observed is if you were towards the center of the galaxy, there would be so much gaseous clouds and everything else that you cannot see the rest of the universe. The fact that we're out here, we actually are able to observe things outside of our galaxy. So again, the fact that God put us out here allowed us to see his creation and observe the universe and make the discoveries that we're doing today that really points to his design. In terms of our solar system, our sun is very unique in terms of being just the right size. If the size of the sun was any larger, it would burn much more rapidly, have an unstable burning, and the temperature fluctuations within where we live on the Earth would be very extreme, and life would not be able to really exist. If the sun was any smaller, the life zone for the planet to have been a life zone, it really needs to be closer in, such as in Mercury or Venus. And one of the things that's unique about those is the planet's rotation is slower than the revolution around the sun. Therefore, one side of the planet faces the sun the entire time and really makes life inhospitable. So you really need to be need to not only have the right size star, but be in the right location where we are here on Earth. And then the moon is very unique in terms of the moon that we have. It really, really provides the life and helps provide the environment for our Earth to have life to exist. And here's a couple things I want to show you. One is, first of all, the moon was really created through a collision of a Mars-sized planet with the Earth several billion years ago. And because of that, it ejected a lot of debris out there that formed the moon. But one thing it did in that collision was it knocked out a lot of the greenhouse atmosphere that would have prevented life from existing. Otherwise, we'd be like Venus, where because of the greenhouse effect, temperatures get up to about 800 degrees Fahrenheit. The second part here was the fact that it enabled our axis to tilt. And this is essential for maintaining that temperature relative of the Earth relative to the sun. So that collision enabled a tilting of the axis. Other planets, for example, the axis is not only not in the right tilt, angle for tilt, but also varies over a period of time, which again prohibits life to exist because of wide variation in temperature. The last interesting thing with the moon and this collision here is it slowed the Earth's rotation from 8 hours to a 24-hour day. When we had an 8-hour rotation, winds on the Earth were about 500 miles per hour. After that collision, and because of the gravity of the moon, it slowed it down to 24 hours and obviously allowed wind conditions to not be quite as extreme in order for life to exist. So again, the moon, the fact that the moon was not only the way it impacted the Earth and helped these conditions for Earth to survive, really is essential for life here on Earth. So because of this fine-tuning, a lot of the folks out there who don't want to believe in God have come up with other theories. And one of the most popular one is called multiple universes or multiverse. And they're saying, sure, we accept the fact that the parameters in this universe is very fine-tuned, but there's multiple universes out there, and again, through this random chance, if you had billions upon billions of universes, one of these universes will happen to sustain life, and we just happen to be in one of those universes. And so this is really given out as the main argument by a lot of atheists who want to say, hey, it's not a designer out there. Again, it's back to this random chance that we happen to be in the right universe. So there's a couple issues with this. The first one is there's really no independent way to prove other universes, at least through scientific study. Again, science is really being able to observe and obtain experiments and repeat those experiments. If you can only test in your universe, which we are kind of constrained and bound to be, it's very hard to test the fact that there are other universes. So again, you're really now going outside the realm of science into the realm of theology and philosophy that the atheists would like to take you there. The other obvious fact is if there are multiple universes, who created this universe generator? Still must be a creator at some point out there. And the last point folks bring out is Occam's razor, which says, the explanation that's the simplest is usually the correct one. So again, the fact that everything points to the designer seems to be a fairly simple explanation. To go to more exotic explanations, like we have multiple universes that are existing outside of our universe, it's just, kind of hard to believe in terms of, one, you can't prove it, and the fact that you're really just now grasping, in my mind, some straws, the fact that you don't want to admit that there's a creator out there. So again, what does the Bible say about creation? In Isaiah 45:18, it says, the Lord says, he who created the heavens, he is God. He who fashioned and made the earth, he founded it. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. Again, the fact that God specifically designed this universe for the fact for life, for us to exist, to be able to discover and worship him. Of course, this is a very familiar verse out of Psalm. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. And in Colossians, for in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So again, no surprise as we look at some of these verses in the Bible match up with the fine-tuning of the universe, the fact that everything points to a creator in terms of the smallest aspects of the physics and the constants out there, to the design of the universe. You can see that, frankly, these things that we kind of knew here in church through the Bible are now sort of being discovered and proven and accepted, again, in the scientific field. How people interpret that may be different, again, with these other theories of multiple universes, but the basic fact is the universe that we live in here is really fine-tuned for life by a creator. So with this, I'm going to turn it over to Jack, and he's going to talk a little bit about the biology side of the house.
Thank you, Didi. No, thanks. Okay, so for the interactive part, I'll ask one question. And you may have heard this one before, but I'm going to ask it. So what happens once every minute, twice every moment, and not once in 100,000 years? The letter M. Just checking to make sure it was awake. All right. So I had two requests from last week, which I shall try to honor. I was asked to speak with a little bit more enthusiasm and a little faster. So I'll try to keep up with that. We'll see what we can do from there. Okay. Make sure it's working. All right. So last week we spoke a little bit about some of the constants of the universe that need to be around to create life, right? We ate a little bit of organic soup. We figured out some of the principles that necessitated the life itself. What I'm going to discuss a little bit more right now is some of the aspects of what would be necessary for the continuance of life. What does it take to make those little cells, make them replicate, and be able to inhabit the earth, as God told us that we would? There's a handout you all have. It's a couple pages long. I forgot last week to give out last week, so you have both. I just ask you to hold it up as you start to fall asleep from what I'm talking. Just use that as your marker for what you're kind of keeping track of. We discussed this a little bit, some of the things to consider. We'll hit this back up in a minute, but it's the constant theme. Science and faith are not mutually exclusive. The two work in concert. As a matter of fact, I would like to argue that God is, in fact, the greatest scientist of them all. He's the one that started all the principles. He's the one that made these foundations that created the universe. And the simple fact that life follows a pattern, that it follows rules, I think is the best indication that God understands science better than we do. He understands all these concepts. Some of the extra names that we throw out there as far as scientists and people who work greatly with faith and science as well. Francis Collins, we discussed last week, the guy who helped discover the genome for the human genome and actually typed it out. Michael Behe, some of you may recognize that name. He's written a couple books about intelligent design and the concepts therein. Michael Ramsden, John Lennox, who you hear a little bit more about in a little bit. All men of faith and all men of science and understanding of these ideas. So as we look towards this, many of us remember this, the tree of life, right? You know, everything coming up from a single base and, you know, coming up through there. Many of you will also remember, and I'm dating myself just a little bit, though, as a wee lad, cosmos. And remember the progression of animals as it went through this music thing that still runs through my head as it goes through. I watch this every year. Some of it like this. Well, sometimes we actually look at it more like this. I think evolution kind of leads itself. For those who can't read it, the guy at the end, it says banking industry. Leads us down through there. So what our understanding of evolution is, what does it lead towards? And is it a chain? Is it an event? Is it a guided process? These are the things we're looking towards. We discussed a little of this last week. Three pillars that make up Darwinism. We have random mutation, natural selection, and long periods of time. These three themselves individually are not in contest. We actually see each of these together. When added together and with the concept of unguided processes, though, is where we tend to start to question the idea. Is there enough time for an unguided process? Are there random mutations quick enough to be able to change species along the way as fast as they're supposed to be? And principally, that long periods of time. We'll discuss a little bit more about that in a minute. Do those three pillars together, guided by an unguided process, as opposed to a God who designs the way these things are supposed to go, doesn't make sense? So keep that in mind as we kind of look through this. So as we go on, for those who have heard of this before, the Cambrian explosion. I'd like to bring this up as a first point. The Cambrian explosion happened about 450 million years ago. Basically what happened is we went from a very small number of animals, just very fine number of species, suddenly to this entire chart. Basically, if you look on the bottom right, what that shows is the ones at the bottom were about how many species were. It's not three, it's a representation thereof. And that shows how big of an explosion happened within about a 20 million year period. 20 million years sounds like a lot until we start looking at the rest of the requirements to make all these species. The fact that they all sprang up all at once is hard for evolutionists to try to explain. It's something, there's a couple theories out there, but nobody can really settle on one. The very fact that speciation happened so quickly, that we had most, if not every other species that exists now, happen within that short period of time, gives pause to evolutionists in trying to explain it as an unguided process. There are very few things that actually make something expand that quickly. So we have to ask that question. In this, they talk about the tree of life we had a second ago. I'd actually argue this is more of a field of grass of life, if you will. All these various species happening all at once don't really necessarily come together as a branch. It's kind of harder to push. So what I'm asking is, and I will look through this along the way, are some of those pillars of Darwinism wobbling? At the very least, in this case, I'd argue that the long periods of time, this is not a long period of time for the speciation to happen, the random mutation, and even the natural selection would not have had enough time to be able to work their way through. Kind of keep that in mind as we go through. The fact that metabolically complex life happened so quickly and changed so rapidly are just evidences towards this fact that evolution cannot explain very easily. Okay, so as we go forward, looking towards some of the concepts of early life. Generally, atheists love to ram down the throats of us rubes who don't understand science very well that there have been millions and millions of years for evolution to catch up. A couple of problems along those lines. So this little critter, known as a cyanobacteria or a stromatolite, it's an entity that was probably somewhere between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years ago. Okay, this should be one of their examples of some of a simple life form that progressed slowly over time. The problem is that little guy actually had photosynthesis started about 3.5 billion years ago. Why is that relevant? Because to have photosynthesis, you have to have something more than a simple creature living off of a rock, chewing up the stuff that's there. The extra number of things that you have to put together into an entity to do photosynthesis is extremely complex. So by saying that we can actually prove, and the way we can prove it, is because this picture right here is in Australia, it's in a shallow water bank. We still have examples, we have fossil record of this, that those formations are these stromatolites that over time have died and basically ossified, they've turned into rock, and then the next ones push up through it and they create more rock. We have records that go back 3.5 billion years. There is a number of scientific proofs that show that it's possible it goes back all the way to, like I said, 3.8 billion years ago. Why is that relevant? Because just prior to 3.8 billion years ago, the land that they were living on was molten lava. You don't have a lot of time to go from molten lava to life evolving. Suddenly, this is more of a problem for an atheist who's trying to explain evolution, because this long period of time that's necessary with all these random mutations and natural selection doesn't have the time it needs to push this together to make photosynthetic life. If you had simpler creatures, if creatures were just living off the mud and all the rest of the stuff, that might work if you had them for millions and millions of years. They don't have enough time to really catch up with this stuff. That's the thing that kind of keep in mind. So without that time period and without that random mutation, another pillar of Darwin's pillars are starting to wobble a little bit. And these are the things that we should be pushing at. Like I said last time, it's not that you have to have a degree to get this stuff, to, you know, discuss this stuff. You simply have a degree of interest and listen to what's kind of, you know, as the atheist explains himself, question his motives, question where he's getting some of his facts from. This stuff is actually published in scientific journals, which even I can read, so I guarantee everybody else can as well. Remember, I'm the Marine. So what does that mean? As we go forward, I want to discuss just a little bit of science. Inside that double helix, which is what's in the background back there, as we discussed last week, it's kind of like a ladder, right? The ladder is made up of two parts that fit together. And we discussed a little bit, some of that's in your handout if you want to get a little bit deeper. But for simplicity's sake, I'll say there's an A and a T and a G and a C that fit together. What are those? They're each one of them molecules that fit together in a rung. Each one of those rungs is called a base pair, okay? Now, the number of base pairs determine how many things, how many traits there are that make you up. Now, I didn't put it on here, but I'll show you as we start going through, I'll discuss the number of base pairs is less important than the fact that there are a lot of them, which is what I'm going to get at. So when looking at a human has about approximately 3 billion base pairs, okay? That doesn't make us the most. There's actually a triffid out there that I think is like 9 or 12 billion base pairs. So apparently that's the one that's going to take over the planet eventually. But these 3 billion base pairs are the things that make you you, that make you unique all the rest along the way, fairly complex creature. Those stromatolites, the cyanobacteria that we talked about a minute ago, those have about 1.75 million base pairs. So to get that, you have to have all 1.75 million base pairs together to make up one of these creatures. That's why I say they're fairly advanced. The smallest replicating entity on the planet, by that what I mean to say is it is able to regenerate itself, it's able to continue on, continue the species, kind of a necessary object for it to, you know, start life and continue it on from there, has about 1.23 million of those base pairs, okay? So, of course, man being man, he had to figure out, can you make it smaller? Can you make it faster? Can you make it stronger? Can you do anything else? This gentleman, Creighton Venter, he decided he wanted to see if he could make a self-replicating unit as small as humanly possible. So the point is to make something as tiny as possible out of the material that's already out there so it would continue to grow and expand itself and could potentially populate the planet. He came up with about 531,000 base pairs. So a lot smaller than we are, but still 531,000 base pairs that have to be together in the right order to make up life. Keep this in mind as we're going along. So anybody who's out there will start to talk about RNA and RNA viruses. These things are smaller. As a matter of fact, you can tell that it's 3,500 base pairs. That's a lot less, only 3,000 base pairs. And you have even smaller ones than that. By the way, that's 80 nanometers for anybody who needs to know. Remember when we started this discussion and a billionth of a meter was a small thing? It was like a big number to try and work through? Well, after Dee Dee's talk, we realized that's not even a blip on the scale. But these things are billionths of a meter long and have all these base pairs in them. Now, next you have basically hepatitis, which has even smaller numbers of base pairs. Why is this relevant? Because at 3,000 base pairs, that's pretty small. There's one problem, though. These are viruses. For them to replicate, they need a host. So if you start with the idea that these things are smaller and could have come first, the question would be, what would they have eaten? So they can't be the first life. You have to go back to those things we were looking at a minute ago. So suddenly you're talking about 1.23 million base pairs, again, is the smallest thing you could have for these guys to eat. So what does that lead us to? It leads us to a chicken and egg scenario. Which came first, the DNA or the RNA? And this is another aspect that's constantly argued through in science. But it always comes back to the same point. Okay, got it. So you built a mousetrap. Okay, why'd you build this mousetrap? Because there's a mouse. Well, why did you, what's the matter with the mice? Well, I wanted the mousetrap to kill the mouse. You need the mouse to have the mousetrap. You need the mousetrap to be able to figure out where the mouse, you know, you keep circling around and around and around and around again, and you're going to get yourself in trouble. So let's talk about some of these numbers, because we've been talking about billionth, and now we've talked about 10 to the 120th, and we've talked about some bigger numbers and everything else like that. I want to give you an analogy to help understand when we start talking about some of these numbers. Has everybody heard the expression that an infinite number of monkeys typing on an infinite number of typewriters will produce Shakespeare, all the works of Shakespeare? Okay, theoretically, this is true. The problem is when you start talking about infinite numbers of anything, as Didi already talked about, there's not an infinite amount of time we've had since the beginning of the earth. Scientists would tell you this. Everyone understands we've not had that much time. So what if you had a lot of monkeys typing on a lot of typewriters? Could you still produce Shakespeare? This was actually kind of funny. It was tried at the University of Plymouth. They took a couple of monkeys, they took a typewriter, and they stuck them into a room and let them sit for a month. Other than using it as a toilet and banging on this thing and trying to, and they eventually broke the typewriter, it produced 5 pages of text, which is relevant. This is actually really important because the 5 pages of text could show words. And when one considers that a word could be the letter A or I with spaces on each side, it's truly relevant to figure out how long would it take the monkey to produce this. In a month, it came up with 5 pages and not one single word. Mostly it was the letter S, a couple other characters along the line, but it never produced that. Now, that was a month. What if it had more time? Well, the problem is if you start with a monkey typing on the typewriter and he's not getting toward that first point, how hard it would be for this monkey to create Shakespeare? I'll give you another analogy. A sonnet, as we've heard, is 14 lines long. The one we most are familiar with is, "Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day?" Has about 114 words, about 500 and something characters in it. I think 626 if you add in all the spaces and such. Were you to lay that end to end and actually randomly type this thing out and have it just randomly generate all the permutations, all the times it would take, you come up with a relatively small number compared to some of what Didi came up with. Actually, in fact, it would be 10 to the 690th power. What is that? It's a 1 followed by 690 zeros. Okay, what does that mean, right? It's a big, huge number. What does that mean? The number is so large, we're going to compare it in a minute. There's not enough time to be able to explain how much time that is. I'll give you an example or two to try and frame that, but I want you to keep in mind 690 zeros. Someone has once said that it's amazing that apparently it's so remote of a chance for God to have created the universe, but apparently monkeys can get it every single time. Keep that in mind as we go through. Matter of fact, this example was so good that anybody heard of Antony Flew? He used to be a huge atheist. Was actually at the beginning of the century, towards the beginning of the century, was the primo book that you read if you were an atheist to try and prove against the concept of God. He argued against C.S. Lewis and roundly beat him. All this stuff, because he heard this example about this Shakespeare piece, he became a deist. In 2010, he died. I'd like to think that he potentially crawled his way out of the primordial azimuth of being an atheist, crawled onto the dry land of being the eternal kingdom. I'd like to think that the man made it at the end, but at least he was a deist. He could not, having looked at this and the impossibilities that we're talking about, kept an atheistic viewpoint. He said it was just illogical. All right. So let's get back to that concept, 690 zeros. What are we looking at? If you started with all the particles in the universe and added all the mass of the universe, you have somewhere between 10 to the 80th power. Again, 80 zeros. It's actually slightly larger. It's between 10 to the 79th and 10 to the 82nd, which is 10 quadrillion vigintillion, which I think I'm allowed to say in church, and 100,000 quadrillion vigintillion atoms. Hopefully that will help explain what that size is. I mean, I can't even imagine what this, but it's a lot, right? 10 to the 80th is what we go with. If you took all that mass and converted it into 1 millionth of a gram microchip, a microchip that was a millionth of a gram, we're talking about like Intel, you know, power to the millionth power, right? Something that small, and it was calculating at a million calculations per second. Since the dawn of time, it had crunched all the possibilities of what it would take to make that sonnet, you would get to 10 to the 90th. You would still need 600 more zeros after it to equal what you'd have to do to try and get to that sonnet, okay? And we're talking about just the Shakespearean sonnet, okay? Try this again. If you were to take all the universe, and we talked about the organic soup last week, if you took 1 centimeter cubes, right, and were running those at a million times a second, that they were churning through all the possibilities of life, trying to put all those organic soup pieces together to make them all come out, you would not go much higher than that 10 to the 90th power. If from the beginning of time, every single second, there were a million attempts at trying to make that life, you would not have enough time. So when an atheist looks at me and says, an infinite number of monkeys, I usually stop and go, listen, if you don't have a million, you don't have an infinite amount of time, if you had the time of the universe, could you do it? And most of them will actually admit that they do not. Again, it makes that question mark. Big numbers, try and round them back around again. Okay, so we talked a minute ago about Craig Venter, and he had created that genome, he created that self-replicating entity, okay? It had 473 genes to it, right? If you took those genes, and for the sake of argument, I'm gonna say that it's either in the right place or it's not in the right place. So that's basically two options. So that's two to some power. So that's two to the 473rd power. That comes out to something with 130 zeros after it, about trying to arrange those genes in the right order. Okay, there's a problem though, because those genes are not simple entities. They themselves have parts to them. Okay, is everyone following that? What I mean to say is, I could take a number of cars and line them up in a row, and then you could have an Autobahn. But if each one of those parts of the car has to be taken into account, you even have more and more and more and more and more. So, boring our way through this, let's say that you took those base pairs, those simple A, T, or G, and C components, and put them together, and put them in a row, and you had 1,000 groups of those together, you'd still have something to the 152nd power. That comes out to something along the lines of 45 zeros after it. Why am I hammering these points, the points about the numbers? Because we're trying to get to the scales of some of the things we're talking about to show how likely or ill-likely these things are to happen. So if you had 152,000 of these base pairs, and they all have to be in exactly the right order to create the life that you actually need, you're talking about something to that power, 152,000 zeros. So I had no idea what that was. So I started running through and I started, okay, what is that size? So I started putting into my little Excel spreadsheet to see what that looked like. So if you put something to the 1,000th power, you have a 300 zeros after it, 301. Put in as high as I could go. You can't go past 1,024, I found it. You can't get to 1,024. That's as high as it gets. It's got 307 zeros to it. After that, Excel just stops. So I went and found a scientific calculator. I had a barter from Didi. That gave me 5,000 zeros. Will give you something along the lines of 1,500 zeros after a 1, okay? After that point, I only got to about 10,000. The computer started to freeze, and after that, I tried to put the whole thing in. And what the thing just stopped. It froze. It couldn't get any farther. Again, who cares? Why do we necessarily need to know all these numbers? Well, the reason is because we're starting looking at trying to understand how big the universe is, or how small these entities are, and how complex they are along the way. Again, we talked about the number of atoms in the universe, somewhere around 10 to the 80. Seconds since the Big Bang, I referred to that a minute ago, there's about 10 to the 17th, okay? About 17 zeros worth of seconds. Some guy came up with, and I don't know, I got this off the internet, so who knows if it's true or not. You can have somewhere about 10 to the 45th reactions per second. In other words, that individual atom can strike about somewhere along the lines in that second of somewhere about 45 zeros worth of things. Like, in other words, that hitting, going around, bouncing, and those interactions. So what is that? It's just like you having a conversation with somebody else and that conversation going on and everyone else's conversation, you know, the telephone game, everyone playing along those lines. That's about as fast as you can get, 45 zeros worth of information or reactions in that 1 second, okay? So what does that give you? If the total number of actions that the atoms of the universe could have created since the beginning of time comes out to about 142 zeros after a one. We still haven't gotten close to 152,000 permutations that it takes to make the smallest created cell that can replicate over time. And stop and think about that, and we're saying that this all happened by chance within the constraints of a force that didn't even have enough time to have created anywhere near enough permutations to make this happen. So there's a number, 2 to the 152,000th. So I come back to the question, whose God's bigger? Are the pillars that Darwinism rests on, are they wobbling? Are they strong? Or they at least have the question that we have to answer the way. Does random mutation, natural selection, and the long periods of time equate to be able to form enough of the calculations to be able to make it even possible that these things exist? And I challenge anybody to explain to me how that possibly could. So where does that leave us? So why do atheists spend so much time trying to prove that there's not an intelligence? Why do they prove or try to prove that there's an unguided process to the whole thing. I'll give you one more example. This one doesn't involve as many numbers, so don't worry. So the longest word in the Oxford Dictionary, okay, is 45 characters long. I will tell you, there is theoretically a 189,000 letter word. It's a chemical. I looked this thing up. It takes 4.5 hours to say. By comparison, the New Testament is about 189,000 letters long. Okay, excluding that thing, that's your 45-letter word. I will not pronounce it, and it is, in fact, an imagined disease that is contracted supposedly from ash and dust particles. You know, somebody came up with that. Okay, longest letter, longest word we can come up with that has an actual intelligible meaning to those of us on the planet. Yet, there's 3 billion letters that make up the DNA sequence in the human. We refer to it as the language of God for a reason. This is what defines us. This is the letter and the alphabet that makes up the word that makes up humans, and that can easily be seen as the word that was spoken to create life. And it's 3 billion characters long. And those are supposed to come together by chance. That's the thing, as you can tell, I've been trying to hammer our way through. Is it possible that this was just created by accident? This gentleman, John Lennox, is a professor of mathematics at Oxford University. Other than this quote that I really like up here that he's got, discussed a little bit about the concepts of the creation of life. And his point that he drew was this. It says, if life did not start as an unguided process, then it spells the end of scientific materialism that Dee Dee and I were speaking about before as a philosophy. It ends it. And that is a very high price for some people to pay. What he's trying to say is that it is not a matter of science for most people. It's a matter of faith on their side. They have a faith in a system that they want to keep. It is sometimes as much of a desire on their part to try and prove a point that it is the logic of these things. By asking these questions, by asking, really, have you considered what 2 to the 157 thousandth power really means, and have them explain this stuff. You don't even need the numbers. The numbers are actually irrelevant. Just ask them, what's the possibility that life is actually created as it has been? What's the possibility that these things have happened by an unguided process? You get into some very interesting discussions, and I think what you'll find is most of them will not try and push their points home. Again, we have discovered and discussed the concepts that religion and science are not at odds. Man's interpretation of them often is. Science is an attempt by humans to try to explain the way the matter works. Religion is our best attempt to walk with our God in our understanding of what he is. He is greater than we are. We are not going to understand all these things, but it's our attempt to do these things. That gives us a bridge to be able to discuss all these points together. We should be able to bond these ideas, not necessarily drive them apart. Finally, a couple of takeaways. The points I want to bring out here are God's time is beyond us. God's outside of time. And C.S. Lewis had an interesting point. He said, with all the time that God has, many people talk about the fact that how could he answer all the prayers? Well, he's beyond that 10 to the 17th number of seconds because he's outside of time. He has all that time plus more to answer these things in his own way, in his own shape. That's how he could do it because he's everywhere at once. It's a concept that's beyond us. But when you start talking about 2 to the 157,000th power, it becomes a little easier to describe the fact that he's probably a little bit more than that. God's power is beyond us. His ability to do these things, to create, to generate, and all the rest of this stuff. God's truth is beyond us. But the thing that we always should take away is that God's love surrounds us always. And that's the thing we have to cherish and to hold. So when we're discussing with our fellow atheists, we need to hold the love of God and try to express that to them mostly. The science, the numbers, everything else will follow as long as they understand, they see us in love, try to explain to them and have a discussion on these points. That's the thing I think that we need to turn over to. With that, I'd like to turn it back over to Dee Dee for a minute, and then we're both going to close out.
Well, hopefully your heads aren't all spinning after the numbers that Jack has thrown out there. But again, two important things to remember, right? Pretty much science has confirmed the Big Bang and the finite time of the universe. So again, there's not time for things to evolve forever and ever, as Jack pointed out. And number two, with the fine-tuning of the universe in terms of the constants everywhere from physics to biology and so on, there clearly is something unique in our universe that didn't happen by random chance. How you interpret that maybe depends on what your philosophical view is, but clearly there is a fine-tuning of the universe. So as you can see on the chart there, and science, like most of us who are scientists, we believe it's objective. How you interpret that science may not be. Again, depends on your worldview. Again, what you've heard here, the science hopefully wasn't too intimidating, but a lot of times you go out and you meet scientists and they seem very intimidating because of the knowledge they have. And certainly respect that knowledge in their scientific field. However, don't be intimidated by these scientists when they go outside of, as I said last time, outside of their scientific field into the realm of philosophy. You really need to know when does science end and when does theology begin. Sometimes scientists really don't draw that line, and they make things appear as science when it really is theology. Again, you can see that quote from Romans there in terms of what God has said from from the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His internal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. And again, you can see it around in our nature, in our design, everything else that God clearly created this earth and really made it evident in that creation. With that, you have one more chart.
So again, all the numbers I gave you were intentionally overwhelming, and for one reason. Science will dump a ton of information on you that sounds scientific-y. I use that term intentionally because it's really not when you come down to it. There is as much evidence on both sides. So take away from this. I think C.S. Lewis says it best. Miracles are a retelling in small letters of the very same story which is written across the whole world in letters. And he says too large, and I'll say too large or too small in the case of things like quantum mechanics, things of the cell, for some of us to see. He also says that a slow miracle is no less incredible than a fast miracle. Whether science dictates that it takes a million years or a trillion years or 100 million years for life to evolve, we can easily point to the fact that it was created and that God has to be the form that does that is the actual point we should drive on. That miracle itself is amazing. Whether it take a minute or a million years, all of it is amazing. And that's that and the cool lion picture, the things you draw from C.S. Lewis. Thank you.
So with that, are there any questions? I know we didn't make this very interactive and kind of threw a lot of stuff out at you, but again, Lee. Pretty small, and again, good point. I kind of lost in the whole fine-tuning aspect, but it is pretty miraculous that that right-sized planet was able to crash into the Earth, again, eject a lot of the greenhouse of the atmosphere, so we have a much thinner atmosphere that can support life as opposed to a greenhouse atmosphere. So all that is. I don't know exactly what the probability is because if you look at the universe and the big space theory, right, the odds of two planets colliding is fairly small.
No, it's a good point. As a matter of fact, and this is why I go back to what I talked about last week. So the acronym BIBLE, we always remember, Basic Instruction for Leaving Earth. You know, so the Bible itself is not a scientific work. If it was, it'd be that high on the ground, right? I mean, it doesn't contain aspects of quantum mechanics. That's why we have DD. You know, if it did have every answer in it, we would have less faith, wouldn't we? So how we bring these things together, also one has to remember, our minds probably couldn't incorporate all of these things. There are aspects of science we will know in 100 years we don't know now, right? If it was in a book right now and you were reading it, how much do you think we'd catch out of it? It'd be about as much as you guys trying to catch up with my numbers system, right? After a while, the numbers just start flowing, you don't quite get it. And a point about watching. So I left off all of the aspects of what creates a god, you know, why does there have to be a god for creation, things like that. But the blind watchmaker theory, even just the watch itself, the simple fact that there's a watch, when you see one lying on a ground, you don't come up to it and wonder, wow, I wonder what unguided processes led to the creation of that watch. You go, no, somebody created the watch. There has to have been. There's too much design in it. We do the same thing, but we won't do the same thing with life. And a number of people have actually brought this. William Lane Craig has a great set of discussions about the fact that even if you take that watch and the concept of design, expand it to the universe, it doesn't take away from the design necessity. But atheists have a tendency to do that. They'll try and block it. Well, it doesn't apply to the universe itself. It's a silly argument that is a desperate attempt to try to explain what can't be explained otherwise.
Yes.
This is why I have Dee. He can explain all the hard ones.
I have a volunteer back there. So again, you're certainly right. None of us were around to directly observe that. You really look at the evidence that was left over. And again, I'm not saying that's the absolute 100% correct theory. That's what's currently the leading scientific theory for the creation of the moon. And what I'm trying to say is, yeah, some people look at that as just a science theory. We can look at it and say, wow, that is really evidence of design. And again, you look at, there's a number of evidence out there, and we can talk offline in terms of why they think the moon was created this way. But for me, it's really in the scientific discoveries that we have and theories and observations they have, there is design everywhere. And it's hard to deny that aspect of design.
The key word you just used is evidence. So you're looking at evidence. And I've done a bit of testifying forensically. And I deal with evidence. But when I look at it and I testify to my opinion as to what it was. Because I can't say what it was. And somebody else, the jury's got to decide what's truth. It's evidence.
And I would add to it by saying this. In the end, we also discussed this last week, and Dee's point about scientific materialism. It has to start with whether or not there's actually truth, right? Because materialism, scientific materialism, often points to the fact that it's based on one's belief, that truth changes based on your observation and how you do things. How would you have evidence, how would you even have circumstantial evidence, if it's all based on your interaction and your belief or your interpretation of truth? If you at least start with the concept that there's a truth, then you can have a discussion with even a scientific materialist. And if they can come to the understanding that there's a truth out there, then what you're both trying to do is you're trying to work your way towards that. Use circumstantial evidence. Use the things that we have on hand and use the things that our brains can work towards to get to that actual truth. But if you can't even start with the truth, then you can't get anywhere with it. You can't even come to an understanding. Once you start to understand there's an absolute truth, you have to ask the question of who determines that absolute truth, which leads you to God, which leads you to the rest of it, right? That's where you started the conversation.
My biggest problem with any of these discussions is that the second law of thermodynamics suggests everything goes from order to disorder, order to chaos. Everything goes from complex to simple. Yet we're talking here about things evolving. Even from a created DNA, they're still talking about evolution. That's...
Oh, yeah. You want a proof of that? Real quick proof. And I got to turn over to Didi because he's the smarter one about the thermodynamics. So somebody pointed out the fact that, you know, it's possible that the total amount of intelligence is actually fixed in the universe, but the fact is the number of people are growing. Think about that for a minute.
Actually, I was going to turn over here to Mark because I think we're running out of time. And
some of the discussion going.